All right, so you're listening to Free Radio Olympia on 98.5 FM. I have Paul Wright from Prison Legal News on the phone. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Tell us about Prison Legal News and how did it start?
Well, I started Prison Legal News in 1990 while I was incarcerated in the Washington prison system, and we started out as a 10-page monthly magazine that was hand-typed and sent out first-class mail, and we've since grown to the point where we're now 56 pages, we're offset printed, and we have subscribers in all 50 states, and we have a paid circulation of around 7,000 subscribers, and we've published, I think we're up to around 250 or 260 issues. We just celebrated our 21st anniversary last month, or I should say this month.
Can you tell us some early stories of Prison Legal News, how it evolved, and your friendship with Ed Mead?
Well, we started out basically focusing as a newsletter focusing on Washington State, and that's the context that we were one of many newsletters and magazines. I think at the time we started in 1990, there's probably around 30 or 40 independent prisoner rights magazines around the country. California alone had six back then. And what's happened is we started publishing, and in the course of us publishing, everyone else kind of stopped publishing. So that by around 2000, there was a couple left, and by 2010, there's pretty much no one left. And that's kind of what's happened along the way, is everyone else stopped publishing. And in the course of this, by the mid-90s, we'd become a national magazine. We didn't start out to be a national magazine. We kind of evolved into one. So that was basically where we got to the point where around the mid-90s, we're looking at our mailing list, and we'd gone from being primarily Washington based and having probably 80-90% of our subscribers in Washington State. We're looking at our mailing list, and we get to the point where we've got more subscribers in California than we did in Washington, and that followed so that we had more subscribers in Texas, and pretty much by the end of the decade, we were, by the end of the decade, it turns out that our circulation is pretty much reflecting the size of the prison populations around the country. We proportionally, we still have more subscribers in Washington State than in any other state, though. But as a general rule, with that exception, our circulation is pretty much follows that of the rest of the prison populations of the rest of the country.
Can you tell us about early attempts at repressing this effort to start this legal news magazine?
Well, the attempts at repressing the magazine have never stopped. It's started from our first issue and continues to this day. Beginning with our first issue, we were initially banned in basically our first three issues were banned in the entire state of Washington. And as we're starting out, we didn't have subscribers per se. We had a mailing list of people that we sent the magazine to that we hoped would subscribe. And that's who we sent it to. And so in the course of this, eventually the Washington DOC were in the process of suing them, and they backed down, and the warden of the penitentiary told me that Prison Legal News wouldn't last more than that it wouldn't last more than 6 months, and that would be the end of us. And so there's no need for them to censor us. Well, turns out that didn't happen. So they stopped censoring us in Washington State. People started subscribing, and as each person subscribed, that let us continue the magazine and keep going. And in various parts of the country, we had problems from the get-go, and that included Washington, included Texas and other states. And then starting around the mid-90s, where this whole, the real tough on crime thing and the repression of prisoners really kind of start cranking out in earnest, we saw a lot more repression aimed at just keeping us entirely out of prisons and jails. Washington State, they started, for example, censoring based on our postage classification, on whether or not prisoners had paid for us on their prison trust accounts, and stuff like that. And we started suing them over it. And initially, we got our first injunction from Judge Quackenbush in Spokane. He says, no, the prison can't censor you based on the postage rate that you're mailed and your nonprofit postage rate. So we figure, okay, well, this is good. Well, the prison officials took that to mean, the Washington DOC took that to mean that they can't censor us based on, they can't censor the magazine, but instead they're going to censor our catalogs and our renewal notices that tell prisoners how to subscribe to us, and if they're already a subscriber, when their subscription is running out, that they need to renew. So we turned around, we sued them over that, and then we wound up getting injunction against that. Then they do the thing of, well, prisoners have to pay for us from their prison trust account in order to receive us. So we got an injunction on that. And, you know, it's, you know, it was just one thing. It's just been one thing after another. And the result is that today the Washington Department of Corrections operates under six prison legal news injunctions, consent decrees, or both, as do a total of eight other states and around 10 other jails around the rest of the country. And currently, right now, the state of Florida and the state of New York, they ban prison legal news in its entirety. We have a bunch of jails that we're suing, including the jail in Spokane, that a lot of these jails, they ban all publications, and all, which means all magazines, all books, all newspapers. Some of these facilities, they ban all mail that is not a postcard, for example. And this is the stuff that we're that we're challenging, that we're suing over, to be able to gain access to the people that are in the prisons or the jails.
It says on your website that Prison Legal News is possibly the most censored publication in America, and I'm wondering, what are prison officials so scared of? What do you publish that's so threatening?
Well, basically what they're scared of is, simply put, you know, they're scared of the truth. And the other thing they don't like, there's a couple of things they don't like, one of which is they don't like the fact that we report the news, and that includes court news and information that tells prisoners what their rights are and how to enforce and vindicate those rights. So that's, you know, that's their thing. One of the things to remember is that in a lot of these places that we're suing, they're not just censoring us, like these places that ban, we're suing a jail in South Carolina, for example. They ban all publications except for the Bible. So in other words, the only book or magazine that prisoners can get in the Monk's Corner Jail in South Carolina is the Bible. In other words, no newspaper, no nothing, you know, just the Bible. So, so in a lot of these instances, I don't think it's necessarily that we're being singled out in particular. I think it's just the whole written word and anything that has any news or information for prisoners is being singled out for ruthless suppression. And I think the reasons for that is, you know, frankly, an ignorant population is more easily driven and manipulated.
Can you talk about jailhouse lawyering and what kind of issues people are working on?
Well, as far as issues goes, I mean, that's really hard to, you know, that's like a really tough question. That's almost like asking, you know, what issues are lawyers outside of prison working on? And the reality is it's pretty much everything that can affect the incarcerated. Primarily, I think most prisoners that are jailhouse lawyers are focusing on their criminal cases and trying to get out of prison or jail. And that's pretty much, especially when it comes to federal habeas corpus, for example, that's kind of like, you know, winning the lottery, in the sense that it happens, it just doesn't happen often. So that's probably the number one thing that jailhouse lawyers are working on. Then conditions of confinement is probably the the next biggest issue out of the conditions of confinement, I would say that the biggest issue there is probably medical care, the lack of adequate medical care. That's a huge issue. So, and then following that are the mundane things that affect a lot of people in prison or out, and that includes family law issues, bankruptcy, and everything from there on out. But I'd say that the biggest thing, obviously, I think that are affecting prisoners are habeas corpus issues, or there are criminal appeals, followed by conditions of confinement, probably distant second.
I read on your website about prison slave labor and the economics of that. Can you talk about that, please?
Yes. Well, one of the things that a lot of people seem to think is that with the Civil War, the United States ended slavery. Well, it didn't end it. It merely limited it to people that are in prison. And this is enshrined in the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that slavery is prohibited in all U.S. territories except for people who have been convicted of a crime. And this is manifested in a number of different ways. One of the ones that we have is some of the issues that we have, for example, are that you've got around 5,000 prisoners that are working in prison industries for private companies. This includes, and we've broken more of these stories than any other media organization out there. And so this will include everything from we've done more stories on this than anyone else. And so some of the companies that in the past have or are currently using prison slave labor include Microsoft, Boeing, Eddie Bauer, Nintendo, and companies like that. So but one of the things that I think that is important to realize is that while the prison slave labor and the companies exploiting it is kind of a big story, as it should be, in a $14 trillion economy, having 5,000 prisoners work for companies is pretty insignificant in economic terms. And rather, I think the bigger issue here isn't the 5,000 prisoners that are working for private companies, nor is it even the 60,000 prisoners that are working for prison industries. And rather, I think that the bigger issue here is the 2.5 million people in prison that aren't working at all. In other words, these are prisoners that have been removed from the labor market. They aren't doing any type of labor. They've been totally removed from the labor market. And that's the type of thing that's inflating, or it's depressing the number, our unemployment statistics. In other words, if the 2.5 million people in prison were counted in the ranks of the unemployed, our unemployment rates would have been, well in the double digits for a long time ago. And then you've also got to factor in the million people or so that are directly employed by the prison and jail industry as guards, secretaries, doctors, the administrators, and stuff like that. So that, I think, is kind of the bigger story than the people that are actually, than the prisoners that are actually working for prison industries.
I read recently about state budgets, say, in California, that they're releasing some prisoners. Is that an overall trend, or is that just a drop in the bucket?
No, I mean, I think as far as the California thing, it remains to be seen if any prisoners are actually going to be released based on the Supreme Court ruling. I mean, the Supreme Court merely upheld a lower court order saying that they have to lower their prison population. They have different ways that they can lower it, and one of which is they can just simply ship all these prisoners out of out of their prison system to, they can ship them out of their prison system to private prisons in different parts of the country. That's one kind of quick and easy way that they can do that. Other things they can do is, that they're talking about doing, is sending, sending a lot of these prisoners to county jails and stuff like that. So whether or not it's actually going to result in the reduction of the prison population, yes, it's going to result in the reduction of the prison population. Whether or not anyone is actually released or released early as a result of the court ruling, I would say remains to be seen.
The greater prison industrial complex, there's a lot of money going into prisons, and the growth of the private prison industry, and then now there's private immigration centers popping up around the country. Can you talk about this, all the money to be made off of prison?
Well, I don't think that it's accurate to say that money is being made off of prisons, rather, you know, because it isn't. I mean, prisons are kind of economic sinkholes. But what does happen is basically prisons are a really good way to redistribute tax dollars so that, and also prisons have also become a jobs program in this country. So basically the ways where, the ways that we see this wealth redistribution taking place is everything from the private prison companies that are using, the mass incarceration as a means to imprison people, and they profit from that. So they're making a living from that. But then we've also got the fact that, you know, you've got almost a million, we have almost a million people that are employed and rely directly on imprisoning people, both as prison guards or, you know, doctors, and then if you start factoring the people that are, that profit on a secondary level from this, and these are the people that make the razor wire, that build the prisons, that, the bond traders that issue the bonds to them and everything else, then the number goes up even higher. You know, I think it's an even bigger number that I think that we see, that we'll see on that. So, but like I said, I don't think that it's accurate to say that that people are, that money is being created from this. This is just a means by which our tax dollars are just being spread around. And I think the analogy there is the defense industry. You know, the Army and the Air Force, for example, they don't create any wealth, but it's a way for our tax dollars to get redistributed to people that profit from it, which is obviously defense contractors, to the soldiers, and everyone else that's feeding into that machine.
21 years ago, how did you get involved in this personally? What inspired you?
I went to prison. I mean, that was pretty much my main thing was, and one of the things that I thought was that, one of the reasons I started Prison Legal News, and I've stuck with it since then, is that I think that one of the things that, one of the worst things that I see happening is the fact that prisoners and their families are the people that are most affected by criminal justice policies, and they have no say in it, and in what passes for debate or discussion in this country. And some of the bigger issues are that the corporate media is pretty god-awful in terms of doing any type of, meaningful discussion about, criminal justice issues. And the other thing, too, is that it's also important to note that we have a bipartisan criminal justice policy. In other words, there's very little, debate or discussion or disagreement between the Republicans and Democrats on locking people up, or, you know, if you're looking at any type of disagreement or differences of opinion on criminal justice policies, I mean, if you look at all the votes that have gone down in the last 30 years, they're pretty much all unanimous. I mean, there's rarely even more than token dissent. I mean, Washington State is a really good example of this. I mean, year after year after year in Olympia, the legislature, they just crank out sentences. They just crank out more and more laws that criminalize more behavior, lengthen sentences, bash prisoners even more. And there isn't even token dissent to this stuff. I mean, it's not even one or two legislators vote against it. I mean, this stuff passes unanimously. And I think that's one of the things that Washington is not unique in this respect. I mean, this is pretty much emblematic of the rest of the country as well. So these are all things that I think they're generally pretty bad about what's happened overall, and this is something I think, you know, just needs to be, that I think is important to emphasize is, you know, what's happened, what's happened along the way here. And that was the reason that, I saw a need for Prison Legal News back in 1990, and I think that need is still, that need is still here.
What kind of changes have you seen in prison populations and the whole conditions of prisons since the starting of PLN?
Well, basically, I'd say the main thing is that when Prison Legal News started in 1990, there were 1 million people locked up in prisons and jails, and there was no civil commitment, for example. Immigration detention was around 6,000 people, and today, basically, the numbers, you know, everything is pretty much exploded. I mean, it's we've seen the massive expansion and increase in the prison population from 1 million to today. There's over 2.5 million people locked up. There's another 20 or 30 sex offenders locked up after their release dates for crimes they or believe they might commit. That law went into effect in Washington State in April of 1990. In our first issue, we published that a month later in May of 1990. So we've kind of had the ringside seat on that. We've seen this massive, almost 600 or 700% increase of our private, of our immigration detention capacity. The private prison industry has gone from basically, a fledgling industry to the point where today they're well established, they're serious political players, and they're not going away anytime soon. And I'd say conditions in prisons and jails around the country are pretty much worse than they've ever been. I think overall it's a fairly grim situation, and across the board things are a lot worse now than they are than they were in 1990 when we started publishing. In fact, I'd say that if you ask me if there's anything that's any better for prisoners now than they were in 1990, but the only thing I can think of is that thanks to the Americans with Disabilities Act, some disabled prisoners have things a little bit better than they did back then. But that's a pretty qualified answer, and it's not a lot to write home about overall.
What do you think everyday people could do to change this whole prison explosion that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, the reality is I think there's a huge disconnect between the rulers and the ruled in this country because, one of the things that comes up is felon disenfranchisement. One of the problems I have as a convicted felon is I live in Vermont, so I can vote. But the problem is I don't have anyone to vote for. And so, you know, this whole thing about about voting for one talking head over another, as I mentioned earlier, since most of the stuff passes unanimously in the legislatures, I mean, it's not like there's anyone in political office that has differing opinions about this stuff. So that's kind of one problem. Other problems are along the lines of the whole foundations of mass incarceration is basically based in sentencing. And it's not that, and to the extent we've had an exponentially growing and continuing to grow prison population, it's not that crime rates have gone up, it's just that people are going to prison and staying there a lot longer. That's pretty much been the problem of what's led to our prison expansion for the last three decades. And so, you know, so that's kind of our problems there. And pretty much the stuff that can kind of be done by individuals includes, of course, you know, you have political campaigns and stuff like that. But, you know, basically the stuff has shown itself to be pretty ineffectual over the last 30 years in terms of trying to do anything about, you know, dealing with the root causes or the expansion of the, you know, of the prison industry in this country. And I've got the thing where I could say that, you know, and I'm certainly in the business of, you know, the so-called raising awareness about stuff. But one of the things I've found is that generally most Americans really don't care about what's happening to other people. In other words, as long as someone else is getting locked up, they don't really care about it. And that's just been our observation. I mean, the bulk of the calls that we field from family members and folks like that are when their loved one gets locked up and is brutalized and mistreated and abused, that's when they're concerned. As long as it's happening to someone else, everyone's fine with it. So...
You all have a current campaign about phone call costs. I was wondering if you could elaborate on
yes,
that.
Yes, we do. And this is one of the, when we're talking about people profiting from mass imprisonment, the prison telephone industry is one of them. And these are companies that basically they are, they gouge prisoners and their families by charging exorbitant rates, for the cost of a prison phone call. Or is it phone calls that cost pennies a minute, they're charging literally dollars a minute. And they give these massive kickbacks to prisons and jails. In fact, Washington State has some of the highest prison phone rates in the country. And these are, you know, this is recently, we did a very comprehensive report on this in Prison Legal News. In fact, the it's on our website, prisonlegalnews.org, and which includes a chart as well. And this includes the fact that pretty much out of 50 states in the federal prison system, around 42 states give these kickbacks, which they call commissions, to the prisons and jails. And it's a huge, it's a huge industry and a huge market. So what we're trying to do now is we're trying to get the government to stop bidding these contracts based on the kickback and just charge, and this is really crazy that they should bid the contracts based on who can provide the service for the lowest cost to the consumer, not based on what is currently done in most states today, which is bidding the contracts based on who's, which phone company is going to give them the biggest kickback. And we have one website now where people, we have a lot more information on that as well. We've got our website that has a comprehensive article on it, which is at prisonlegalnews.org, and the companion website is prisonphonejustice.org.
Well, thanks for talking on the radio, Paul. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Well, this is literally a topic that, you know, we can go on literally for a long time because it's a pretty massive topic. It's also one of the things, too, is that the problems that are affecting American prisoners in jails have kind of seeped out into society at large. Everything from health issues to unemployment and things like that. One of the things to keep in mind is the United States may not have a public policy in a lot of things. We don't have a public health policy, we don't have a public mental health policy, we may not have much in the way of housing for the poor, but instead of all that, we've got a prison policy. And the prison system is pretty much a tool of social control that exists to control and contain poor people, and it's working pretty good. And that's why it continues to increase exponentially. So, and anyways, I hope people can check out our website. We have our magazine on there as well. All 250-plus issues are available online. And we also operate a free listserv, too. So if people want to know what's going on, we can give you all the information you need to stay informed and hopefully figure out a course of action on things.
Cool. Well, thanks again for being on the radio.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And that was Paul Wright from Prison Legal News.